Prize-winning investigative journalist at The New York Times since 2016, his reporting has focused on Donald Trump's personal finances. Next up to The Hague, where the International Court of Justice is holding a six-day hearing where over a quarter of the world's countries are testifying against Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories. Stay with us. Shine before me by Zenobia. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We go now to The Hague, where the International Court of Justice is holding a six-day hearing as over 50 countries are testifying against Israel's occupation of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza. It's the largest ever participation in world courts history. Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki said Monday, quote, "The genocide underway in Gaza is a result of decades of impunity and inaction." Riyad Mansour, Palestinian envoy to the UN, delivered emotional testimony Monday.
The state of Palestine appeals to this court to guide the international community in upholding international law, ending injustice and achieving a just and lasting peace, to guide us towards a future in which Palestinian children are treated as children. Not as demographic threat, in which the identity of the group to which we belong does not diminish the human rights to which we are all entitled. A future in which no Palestinian and no Israelis is killed. A future in which two states live side by side in peace and security. The Palestinian only people only demand respect for their rights. They ask for nothing more. They cannot accept nothing less and nothing else. The future of freedom, justice, and peace can begin here and now.
That was Palestine's permanent representative to the United Nations, Riyad Mansour, addressing the International Court of Justice Monday. Earlier today, South African Ambassador Vusi Madonsela addressed the court.
The inordinate delay in achieving a fair and just settlement has resulted in an unending cycle of violence. A clear legal characterization of the nature of Israel's regime over the Palestinian people can only assist in remedying the ongoing delay in achieving a just settlement. We as South Africans sense, see, hear and feel to our core the inhumane discriminatory policies and practices of the Israeli regime as an even more extreme form of the apartheid that was institutionalized against black people in my country.
For more, we're joined from The Hague, where the ICJ hearing is taking place, by Ahmed Aboufoul, legal research and advocacy officer at the Palestinian human rights organization Al-Haq. He contributed to their advisory opinion on the case. Welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. This is historic, what's taking place right now, Ahmed, at the International Court of Justice. More than half the world's countries are participating in this. Talk about the significance of this. And although we just played the South African envoy's comments, this is not to be confused with that other case, the South Africa bringing the case around genocide against Israel in the court that just happened a few weeks ago.
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you for having me again, Amy, and congratulations on Democracy Now!'s 28th anniversary. In this dystopian age of misinformation and biased media, especially in the West, we value your work and we congratulate you and hope your viewer will continue to support your important work. You're absolutely right, Amy. This is a historical moment. For over 57 years, Israel has been perpetuating its occupation in the occupied Palestinian territories, dominating every aspect of their lives, and maintaining this occupation to further facilitate and impose this apartheid regime imposed on the Palestinian people as a whole. One of the important features of this occupation is that it is colonial in nature. So it's combined with the continued unabated building of settlements and the theft of land and the demographic manipulation and engineering of the occupied Palestinian territory in an attempt to empty it from its indigenous people. A very common feature of colonial regimes and projects trying to steal the land without the people. This is a historical moment, Amy, because this is, as you mentioned, the case with the most interest by states in the history of the advisory opinion procedure before the court. And it shows you that the world have something to say about this occupation. The whole body of occupation, of the law of occupation, shows us that occupation was not intended to last that long. Occupation is temporary in nature. But the way Israel perpetrated occupations shows that Israel is not interested in ending that occupation, but it actually needs that occupation to further implement its strategy to acquire more land by force with as less Palestinians as possible. And therefore, the premise of this case, I think there are three main legal arguments: that Israel is violating what we call in international law peremptory norms, from which no derogation is permitted. So the first norm that Israel is violating is the acquisition of territory by force or the threat of the use of force. The second is Israel's violations of the Palestinian people's right to self-determination, which is also a peremptory norm, and the opposition of regime of racial discrimination and demographic manipulation in the occupied Palestinian territory and beyond. That is a regime of apartheid imposed on the Palestinian people as a whole, denying them their unalienable rights, including Palestinian refugees who continue to be denied their right to return to their homes and villages. So this is an important moment where for the first time, we would have the principal organ of the United Nations telling us the legal consequences of Israel's occupation. And it will be extremely difficult for Israel's allies after that to justify Israel's actions in any way possible. Israel has been instrumentalizing the rules of international humanitarian law, the body of law that governs the situation of occupation, to further its settler colonial project in Palestine. I think after this decision, which I have no doubt that the court will decide that Israel's occupation is illegal, it will be very difficult to support Israel and its policies by Israel's allies, including the U.S. So all eyes on the U.S. and how it will react to this important ruling.
And Ahmed Aboulful, I wanted to ask you, for those who are not familiar with these international legal bodies, could you briefly summarize the difference between the International Court of Justice proceedings and the separate case that South Africa filed, the complaint of genocide at the International Criminal Court against Israel, especially in terms of the jurisdiction or the powers of the court to have any direct effect on Israel's actions?
Yes, absolutely. I think you meant South Africa's genocide case before the very same court, the International Court of Justice. And these are two different proceedings. The International Court of Justice can look into advisory proceedings where any organ of the United Nations can ask the court to provide a legal opinion on what the court thinks of a certain matter. Usually such rulings are non-binding for states, but they're of particular importance as they guide the whole United Nations and the member states in how to approach a certain matter or a certain question. The other type of procedure is contentious cases where states take each other to court when they have a disagreement on a matter of international law. So, for example, a disagreement on the interpretation of a particular convention to which both are parties and have accepted the court's jurisdiction. And that's exactly what South Africa did in the genocide case against Israel on the interpretation of the genocide convention, where it took Israel to court. So it's a case between South Africa and Israel. While in the advisory opinion proceeding, there are no two parties. There's only the court that is deciding on a matter of question, and all states around the world are invited to provide their written statements, their oral interventions, to tell the court what is their position, what is their interpretation of the law on that particular matter. Because international law is made by the practices of these states and what states around the world have accepted to be customary international law and have accepted to be the common interpretation of international law. So the law on occupation, as I said, is clear that the occupation was not intended to last that long and is temporary in nature, but it didn't set any time limit in which occupation has to end. So that's how Israel has been perpetuating this, often described as prolonged occupation. It's the longest occupation in modern history, claiming under the usual security pretext that it needs to continue its control and needs to continue its domination of the Palestinian people and its violations of the perimetry norms.
And what is the role of the public in these cases? Is there any?
Of course, absolutely. The public, you know, don't have a standing in procedure or like civil society organizations, for example, like the one I'm proudly associated with, that is Al-Haq, can always submit to the court, but these submissions are not part of the proceedings. They're available at the seating of the court for states participating in the proceedings, but also for judges to read them and consult them. And we have already published a position paper outlining the key legal arguments in this case and our view on how the court should approach this case. But if you allow me, these rulings are usually of particular importance to be used after. So how, for example, the state in question will utilize this ruling in its diplomatic efforts, whether taking this ruling to the General Assembly to adopt a resolution to the same effect, or perhaps to the Security Council. Although there will always be the U.S. Veto. So what comes after that decision, I think, is also of a particular importance. And historically, the ICJ cases have served in a way to provide guidance on what international law says and how states should behave. Obviously, not always states have listened to such rulings or they try to disobey them. But for example, in the situation in South Africa and the ruling on the illegal presence of South African apartheid in Namibia, it served and it created momentum for the mobilization on the ground, which eventually led to the end of that regime. So hopefully this advisory opinion is also another step forward to ending Israel's settler colonial and apartheid regime imposed on the Palestinian people as a whole.
Can you talk, Ahmed Abouful, about the response of the court? This is when it was run by Joan Donahue. And important to point out, she came out of the State Department. She's the head of the International Court of Justice. But she is no longer the head of the Court of Justice. But it was under her, and it was her reading of the preliminary decision around South Africa bringing its genocide case to the court. If you can talk about who's the new head of the court. And then I want to ask you about what just happened in Israel and the Knesset voting not to expel Ofer Kassif, the lawmaker who's a member of the Hadash party supporting the genocide case against Israel at the ICJ. I just wanted to play a clip of the Knesset member Kassif speaking to Democracy Now! About facing expulsion, which didn't happen.
They want me and my friends to shut up. They don't want us to raise our voice against any kind of violence. Because as I said million times, as someone who continuously for years object and oppose the Israeli occupation and siege against the Palestinian people, we said, I said explicitly, that even the crimes of the siege and the occupation cannot and will never justify the massacre committed by Hamas. We added that the massacre, the criminal massacre by Hamas, cannot justify the massacre and assault of Israel on Gaza, in which around 30,000 people are already dead, were killed. The vast majority, more than 70%, are innocent civilians, around 10,000 children.
So that's a member of the Knesset who remains so because they lost the vote to expel him, Ofer Kassif. And if you can respond to the new president, Nawaf Salam, who's replacing Joan Donahue.
As you said, Judge Nawaf Salam, who is a Lebanese judge, he has been a member of the court since February 2018 and newly elected as president of the court since 6th of February 2024. He is now the president of the court. But if you allow me, whether him or the American judges before the ICJ, they don't serve as agents of their state of nationality. They serve as independent judges who provide their personal views about international law and the interpretation of international law after hearing the positions of the states. So it is not usual to presume that because of the nationality of the president of the court, that the position will be aligned with the foreign policy of the state of that judge. That is not the case, whether American or Lebanese or any other nationality of the president of the court. It is presumed, and the presumption is of their professional way of work and deliver on their mandate in accordance with the law. As to the voting to expel Ofer, member of Knesset, it also, in my view, it shows you how radicalized Israeli society has become. So even the very tiny minority that you have where Israeli Knesset members are calling for the end of the occupation or calling for the bare minimum of human decency, that is a ceasefire, the rest of Knesset members from the Israeli members are mostly against that. And such tiny minority of those who call for Palestinian rights are often attacked. And as you said, there was an attempt to even remove him from the Knesset. And I think it's very telling to see also how supportive Israeli society has been in the genocide against the Gaza Strip. Amy, we need not to forget that right before the war, the Israeli society mobilized hundreds of thousands in the streets because of Netanyahu's plan to attack the judiciary or to minimize their authority in reviewing government's decision. But when it comes to Palestinians who are being oppressed, who are only a few meters away, the Israeli society somehow is unable to mobilize or call for the end of the occupation. So in a way, it seems that the Israeli society has been radicalized into believing that for them to enjoy the privileges of this apartheid regime, they don't mind the Palestinians being oppressed. And unfortunately, the foreign policy of states that claim to be friends to Israel, I think, have contributed profoundly to such radicalization, simply because they've been ensuring impunity for Israel and Israeli war criminals who have been committing crimes for the past decades. So I think, in a way, the reason that we have such extreme government at the moment, one of the most extreme and right-wing in the history of Israel, which has ministers who are proudly self-described as Islamophobic and homophobes and fascists and racist ministers like Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, is a result of, in my view, of the U.S. and European foreign policy ensuring that Israel enjoys an exceptional treatment, that Israel is untouchable. It enjoys prevailing impunity where Israel can commit crimes, but no one is held accountable.
Ahmed, I'm so sorry that, well, when we last spoke, you'd already lost some 60 members of your family born and raised in Gaza. You are. And I wanted to just ask in this 30 seconds, about Benny Gantz's comments, part of the War Council, saying if the hostages are not home by Ramadan, which is like March 10th, the fighting will continue everywhere, including Rafah.
Yeah, well, it shows you also the character and the behavior of Israel. Israel is behaving like a pariah, is behaving like a rogue state, is not listening to anyone, is not listening to its closest allies. Israel needs to have the humility to understand that the Palestinian people are free people, are not colonial subjects. They're entitled to their rights, and Israel at some point will need to sit and listen with seriousness to the and consideration to the aspiration of the Palestinian people. The Palestinian people, Amy, are not asking for a favor. They're asking for their unalienable basic human rights. And I think the world for long has misunderstood the Palestinians. We're not even asking. We're demanding those rights. We're entitled to those rights, regardless of what Israel think about that.
Ahmed Abu Ful, we want to thank you for being with us, legal research and advocacy officer at the Palestinian human rights organization Al-Haq, speaking to us from The Hague. Next up, we turn to a surgeon who's just returned from Gaza, wrote an L.A. Times op-ed headlined, "I'm an American doctor who went to Gaza. What I saw wasn't war, it was annihilation." Back in 20 seconds. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show on Gaza, where the death toll since October 7th is nearing 30,000. Amidst worsening hunger, UNICEF is warning that the war-torn territory is, quote, poised to witness an explosion in preventable child deaths, which would compound the already unbearable level of child deaths, unquote. On Monday, Palestinians rushed to get sacks of flour from a UN distribution center in Gaza City. This is a displaced Palestinian named Abdullah Sawaf.
Because we want to eat, we are dying of hunger. Why would someone put himself at risk of dying by coming here? It is in order to feed the children. We are dying of hunger and there is no food or drink left in Gaza. There is a famine.
Meanwhile, Israeli forces reportedly opened fire again at crowds waiting for humanitarian aid. We go now to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by Dr. Irfan Galeria, a plastic and reconstructive surgeon just back from volunteering in Gaza with the humanitarian aid group Med Global. His L.A. Times op-ed headlined, "I'm an American doctor who went to Gaza. What I saw wasn't war, it was annihilation." Welcome to Democracy Now!, Doctor. Explain what you saw, why you call it an annihilation.
Certainly. Amy and Juan, thank you so much for having me on the show, and congratulations on 28 years. Look, I understand in war, you're going to have collateral civilian casualties. You'll have displaced citizens. But what I saw when I was in Gaza and what my team saw was vastly different. What we saw was a collateral humanitarian crisis of an unimaginable scale. Over 1 million civilians struggling to survive, struggling to find shelter, struggling to find food, struggling to find drinking water. And what we also saw, what appeared to be a deliberate attempt to strangulate these civilians. We saw, while we were driving to Rafah, miles of trucks lining the road on the Egyptian side waiting to enter. You know, Amy and Juan, what's a very telling statistic is before this war began, almost 500 to 600 aid trucks would cross through the borders daily. It shows you how dependent this country was on aid, even before the war. But now, after the war, or during the war, the need is even greater, and less than 100 trucks are allowed to enter. What I also saw, and what our team also saw, was a deliberate attempt to incapacitate the healthcare system. The healthcare system in Gaza has collapsed. Hospitals have been targeted. They no longer have the physical capacity or space to care for their patients. Physicians are being killed. Healthcare workers are being killed. They're being targeted. They're being imprisoned. There's no medical aid or medical equipment that's coming through. You know, we operated under unsterile conditions, and we had outcomes and procedures that we had to perform in Gaza, unfortunately, because we didn't have access to basic medical equipment and aid. And the last thing I would like to add is, while they're facing this humanitarian crisis, they're facing a relentless attack. Bombs and missiles regularly. And to me and to my team, there did not seem to be a distinction between any military, soldier, terrorist targets versus civilian targets. The stories we heard over and over again were the same. We took care of patients and civilians that were sleeping in their homes. I'll give you one example. There was a young child, he was 14 years old, a boy who I'd taken care of. He sustained what's called an open fracture on his left leg. He lost so much flesh that his bone that was fractured was exposed. His story was that he was lived in Khan Yunis, and they went to a local school trying to seek shelter with other families. That school was bombed, and his entire family was killed, and he was orphaned. So there seems to be a deliberate attempt to target civilians, and there doesn't seem to be a very reasonable attempt to protect them in this conflict.
And Dr. Ghilari, you wrote in your LA Times piece, I couldn't help thinking that the lucky ones died instantaneously, either by the force of the explosion or being buried in the rubble. The survivors faced hours of surgery and multiple trips to the operating room. Could you talk about some more about the conditions under which you performed surgery while you were there?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been in war zones. I've operated in small hospitals in Africa. I thought I was going to be prepared, but I was not prepared for what I saw here in terms of not only the equipment and materials that I had access to, but the patients that I was taking care of. We lacked, as surgeons in the hospital then, basic equipment and basic materials such as sterile drapes, basic surgical equipment. There are a lot of procedures that we couldn't perform because we didn't have access to that equipment. And as a result, patients suffered because we couldn't provide them with procedures or services that we could have provided for them here in America.
Dr. Irfan Ghilari, we have to end the conversation here, but we're going to continue online at democracynow.org. People can hear and watch our web exclusive. Dr. Ghilari is a plastic and reconstructive surgeon. He wrote an LA Times op-ed headlined, "I'm an American doctor who went to Gaza. What I saw wasn't war. It was annihilation." That does it for our show. Happy belated birthday to Neil Shabata. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Faust, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Sharifa Gokuduz, Messiah Rhodes, Noreen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Malkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, and Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Trolling college music so you don't have to. No loyalties, no orthodoxy. Q. Keeping it real, dumb, and organic since 2019. Tune into Home of Burnaby Rock with John on Fridays from 6 to 8 p.m.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.